Okay. Well, last week we saw that the Israelites and the Philistines were still at war, just as they had been all throughout Saul's reign. And we talked about how they were in this face-off with the two enemies looking at each other across the valley. And then out of the Philistine camp comes their champion, Goliath, the giant. So we talked for a while about Goliath and his origin, how his origin was really demonic and how terrifying he was. And we said Goliath was what they called a man of the in-between. This was a man who would challenge the other army to give him an opponent so that they could fight in single combat. And this was a winner-take-all kind of battle. So if Goliath wins the battle, then the Israelites would become the slaves of the Philistines. And if the champion of the Israelites were somehow able to defeat the giant, then the Philistines would become the slaves of the Israelites. But of course, Goliath was so big, we said in our measurements he's about 9'9". He was so big that when the Israelites heard his challenge, of course everyone was terrified, including King Saul. And we also said that this chapter was really pivotal in the history of Israel as we see David coming into the spotlight for the first time. So there are a lot of contrasts to notice in this chapter, just as there are all throughout 1 Samuel. So you have the comparison in this chapter between fear and faith, of course. And also the comparison between professionalism, right? Being a professional leader or professional religious person or someone who operates in the power of the flesh versus someone who is moving in the anointing of God. So where we left off was we saw Saul and his army terrified of Goliath as he challenges them. So we pick it up at verse 12 of 1 Samuel 17. And the Bible says, "Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons. And the man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest. And the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem." All right, so here we get some background on David. And this type of description, you may know, you may see this type of description in other places. This is the type of description that Bible writers would use when they want to introduce somebody. Or for them, this is kind of like a chapter heading, if you will. So this is the writer's way of letting you know, because of how he's introducing David, that David is now going to be the main character in the story, which he's going to be, obviously, for many chapters. And it references his family background. So Jesse and his people, his family, they come from a region called Ephratah. You may remember that in the Christmas prophecy that we heard a few weeks ago, right, that Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. It refers to it as Bethlehem Ephratah. Jesse is an elderly man by this point, so we're not exactly sure, but the way they use this phraseology means that he may be 70 or he may be 80 by this time. So this could be another reason why David was perhaps neglected in comparison to his brothers, if that's the right word for it. Perhaps everybody saw David as the runt of the litter. And it's possible that his brothers were a lot older than he was. So there is no mention of David's mother at this point. You might have noticed that. Although we do know that at this time his mother was still alive. It's interesting. Because of how poorly David was treated, there's been speculation that he might even have been illegitimate, actually. We just don't know. But what we do know, what we've seen already in a couple of these little vignettes, is that they don't seem to have thought very highly of David or thought that he was going to be anything of any great significance. So he already has these 3 brothers in the army. And if you remember, these are the 3 guys who had been brought to pass in front of Samuel on the day that David was anointed. And it sounds like they had joined the army on their own initiative. So they're good, you know, patriotic Israelites. And apparently David was allowed to go home and work from time to time. So this is an agricultural society, right? And so people understood that it was necessary to take care of those things at certain seasons of the year and so on. We don't know how long it's been since the last time that Saul saw David. And that may be why, when you get to the end of this chapter, as we'll see in a little bit, that Saul no longer recognizes David even, which is interesting. But verse 16, now David is going to arrive at the camp for this fateful showdown. Verse 16 says, "The Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening." So this is his routine every day. Morning and evening, Goliath continues to dare the Israelites to meet his challenge, right? How many of you know this would get old after a while, right? Every morning and every night, here comes the giant. Come on, bunch of chickens, you know, send me out somebody to fight me. And so this went on every day for 40 days. So they endure 40 days of humiliation. And that number is not by accident, because in the Bible, 40 is a number that speaks of trials and testings in the Bible. And if you've already turned 40, you know that's true, right? But it's a number in the Bible that talks about God testing our faith, right? Noah, he saw it rain for 40 days and 40 nights. Israel, when they disobeyed God, they had to wander around in the wilderness, right, for 40 years. Jesus himself in his temptation in the desert, right? 40 days. So there's a significance to that number. And this was certainly a trial of faith for Israel. Were they going to have the faith? Was anybody, or was the whole nation, going to respond to this challenge of the, really, it was a challenge from the devil, right? So verse 17, this is one of those meanwhile back at the ranch moments. Then Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp. And carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their thousand, and see how your brothers fare, and bring back news of them." Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So they're still right where they've been. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things, and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, and we're dreadfully afraid. So you got the picture. So everybody's like, yeah, rah, rah, you know, whipping each other up, psyching each other up. And then they go out there. And as soon as they do, they take off running, right? So David heard them. Verse 25. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he has come up to defy or to shame Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel." So David, and I like this, David was a very faithful and dutiful son. The contrast between him on one hand and Saul on the other, it is apparent, and it's a jarring contrast. Notice how here's a kid, really. We would say he's a kid. He's about 16, and he receives this command from his father, and he's able to carry it out on his own with faithful planning and faithful implementation. And if you remember how we were first introduced to Saul and the bad portrait of Saul that was painted for us right from the outset, David is the anti-Saul. Right. So first thing you see about David, he's not a normal teenager, because it says he gets up early. Right. David gets up early, whereas Saul, if you remember, Saul slept in. David is responsible. He leaves the sheep who he's watching. He leaves them with a keeper. Whereas when we first meet Saul, where is he? Looking for lost animals. David takes the items and he goes. So he made sure everything was put together, or else he gathered it all himself. He arrives at the camp, and again, unusual for a young person in his excitement, before he greets his brothers or does anything else, he brings the supplies to the supply keeper. So if you're reading these details carefully, you see the writer is deliberately giving you a very detailed picture of his actions, just as he did with Saul, to show you that David is an extremely responsible man, young man, whereas Saul was a mess. So he's diligent, he's responsible, and he gives his father, unquestioning obedience, right? So he is on a mission from his father, though, and he intends to fulfill it faithfully. Jesse wanted news. The internet was down that week, and Jesse wanted a report on his three oldest boys. So he sends, like a good dad, he sends this care package for them of bread and grain. Now, the rabbis tell us that the ephah of grain was about 35 pounds. So David is not a wimp. He is used to carrying around loads. I don't know how big all these cheeses were, but you've been down to Arthur Avenue, cheese can be big, right? These were not slices of cheese. These were cheeses. So Jesse seems to know that David can handle this mission at his young age, that he'll be fine on his own. And Jesse has no worries, apparently, that David's going to get sidetracked, go fool around and, wander off somewhere. This is a trip of about 12 miles, so it's about a four-hour walk for him, and he probably had a donkey or something or two with him, which would have slowed him down. So, but again, why am I giving you, or why does the writer give you all these details? Because the writer, and really it's the Holy Spirit, wants you to see how favorable all of these details are, what kind of a responsible young person David is compared to the details that we were given about Saul when we first met him. Now, David apparently comes from a family of clever people. Jesse is clever. He sends David with 10 cheeses for his son's captain. Now, the way the Israelites had organize their armies, you go all the way back to the time of Moses, and you had captains of 50, you have captains of 100 over them, and at the top of the food chain were captains of 1,000. So probably the only people that were over them were the general and the king. So, but Jesse, David's dad, knows that a little gift of cheese doesn't hurt to give to the commanding officer. But why 10? Why 10 cheeses? I mean, how much cheese can somebody eat, really? I like cheese, but really. Well, think about it. The captain of 1,000, he says to David, give these 10 cheeses to their captain of 1,000. Well, the captain of 1,000 had 10 captains of 100 under him. So he could send these cheeses, down the line, and everybody would have a good party that night, courtesy of Jesse, and it would give, in the army, good feelings about Jesse's son. So very clever. David, of course, as any teenager would be, is excited to be there, see what's going on. And so as we read, when the army goes out to fight with all their shouting and hoopla, here comes Goliath, and David hears the challenge, but of course the entire army takes off running as soon as they see him. Now, we don't know if it's just a rumor, but the soldiers, at any rate, seem to think, it seems to be the belief in the army, that they will be handsomely rewarded if they kill Goliath. You get to be rich, you get to be the king's son-in-law, and guess what? Tax-free for life. So that's about as good a deal as you could get in the ancient world, and it wouldn't be too bad in the modern world either. So verse 26 now, David arrives, he gets the scene, he gets there, he says hello, and all of a sudden he's the only guy there because everybody else is going in the opposite direction. So David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" In other words, wait a minute. Let me see if I got this straight. What kind of deal is this, did you say again? So, "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" The people answered him in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." So they give him the whole list again. Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, and he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" Then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones did. So you got the picture. David's just like working the crowd now, right? So he wants to know what kind of deal this is. But more importantly, and we touched on this last week in our question and answer time, you notice that David is more concerned than anything about the reproach or the shame that is being put on Israel. And he is outraged that Israel is in this condition of running away from their enemies, because David is the only one there that has enough faith to understand and act on the fact that Israel's army is actually the army of the living God, or one of them. God has two armies. God has two camps, his camp below and his angelic camp above. So who is this Philistine? He says, not to defy the army of Saul, not to defy the army of Israel, but to defy the army of the living God. So isn't it possible that David has this faith because he's the only one who is seeing things accurately with the eyes of faith, and that gives him courage? So the men tell David, "Yep, that's the deal, buddy. If you kill this giant, that's the deal for you." Now, his oldest brother gets mad at him because imagine now you're the big brother and here comes the little brother. And David is, at least as he sees it, David is popping off, making trouble, right? Because everybody's afraid. We're in a very bad state here. Things are very perilous. We could lose our national freedom. People can get killed. And here's my brother, the religious nut, making trouble. So you got to look at it from the standpoint of the big brother. David's talking all kinds of religious talk, which you know is always so welcome in the army, right? He's doing this, going around from person to person, telling soldiers that God's honor is at stake, which is probably not well received in 1017 BC, just like it isn't in, 2018 AD. So he goes after David, and I think you can probably also see here that maybe his perception of David and who David is, or who David has become, is out of date. Maybe he's thinking of a younger version of David that he used to know from back in the day, but David is no longer that person, and Eliab doesn't know that yet. So he's playing this role of a dismissive big brother to a T, accusing and judging David. Don't forget also, and here's a real interesting side of it, that Eliab, the firstborn, was passed over by God and by Samuel to be the next anointed one. You remember, he comes into the room like, "Yeah, I'm the oldest, I'm big, I'm tough, I'm a good-looking dude," and nope, that's not the one. Don't look at his outward appearance. So, you would feel not quite so good about that. No, sorry. God has rejected you for the job, right? So, and Eliab was one of a very few people anywhere who knew that David himself had been anointed by Samuel. So this is actually dangerous. What if my big mouth religious zealot brother accidentally pops off and lets it slip that Samuel has anointed him to be the next king? That would be real bad. Because what would happen to Eliab and the other Ab and Shammah and, right? Saul would kill all of them. So David famously replies, "Is there not a cause?" That may not be the best translation, really. Most translations now would render that as saying, "Isn't it just a word?" Or David was saying, "Aren't I just asking a question?" Words to that effect. So in slang, we would say, "Hey, I'm just saying. I'm just asking a question. I'm just saying, what's the problem?" Then he doesn't stop. He just keeps going around and asking people about it. So in verse 31, David apparently is making a little bit of a ruckus because he actually gets hauled in front of the king because he's got enough people riled up in the camp. So verse 31 says, now when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, now notice, nobody has said anything to David, right? David is so charged up. There's none of this, you know, children should be seen and not heard. There's none of this, you know, don't speak until you're spoken to. David gets brought in front of Saul and he says, sup, king? Right? Let no man's heart fail because of him. I love that. There's no mention of the, don't worry about the giant. David's like, walks in, king, don't let anybody's heart be worried about him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Dismissive, right? Bold, doesn't even give him a name. He's just that uncircumcised guy out there. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight for him, for you are a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. Not to mention that he's 9'9", right? But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine, which, by the way, that's, of course, accurate in terms of their custom of not being circumcised. But for Jews or Israelites, it was would have meant for them this disgusting. So you got to hear it like that. He's really saying this disgusting Philistine will be just like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Saul himself hasn't even come out and said, hey, guys, this is the army of the living God. But here's David throwing it in his face. It's almost, I don't know if Saul received it that way, and it wasn't David's intention, but it really is a rebuke to Saul, the way that David even puts this in his own mouth. Moreover, David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. So, what's astonishing to me is that David, who's a teenager, is the one who is actually engaged in alleviating everybody else's fear. So there again, his character. Notice also that, again, as a teenager, he's still very respectful, and he refers to himself not as me. He refers to himself as your servant. It's interesting. There's something in here where Saul's craziness kind of gets softened by David's presence, David's approach. I don't think there's any mockery in here. This is the gentlest that we've seen Saul for many chapters, right? He's almost like fatherly to him. He says, you can't do this. You're just a young person. And he's been fighting since he was a young person. I don't think there's any mockery there at all. But he speaks about his own experience. And you know, I want to suggest to you that in this culture, David's story actually made him sound reasonable. Many times we read this and we think it's crazy. We can't understand why did Saul let David do this, knowing how much was riding on the outcome, right? So that's been a common question down through time. Why did Saul allow this kid to do this? But David's story made it seem reasonable because shepherding was very hazardous. And it's true that in this era of history, the Middle East still had many wild animals of this type. You and I think that they're only maybe in Africa and India, right? But lions and bears and so on were still all over the Middle East. So David was not only filled with faith, he had also spent a good amount of time in God's training ground. He had faced physical dangers, obviously. He was tough. He had not spent his childhood on the sofa playing Xbox. He had spent his childhood living outside, sleeping outside. Frost, you know, it does get cold there sometimes, right? It's not just completely poetic when it says, on a cold winter's night that was so deep. You're sleeping outside in the winter, and so on. Jesse was, I think, a wealthy man, but David had not been raised the way that Saul had been raised. We are meant to believe from that first couple of chapters where we meet Saul that Saul was raised as a spoiled rich kid who didn't even carry any money around with him, borrowing money from his servant. But David had spent his childhood in maybe the toughest profession that his society had to offer at that time. Now, we don't think of David like that because we want to think of him as being delicate somehow, because he's this wonderful musician and he's a youth and he's red-cheeked and all this, and he plays his harp and oh, he plays so beautifully. I want you to consider the other side of this man, this young man, that he is tough in a way that most young people, at least in our society, are never tough anymore. But that's who David actually was. And given that David was a shepherd and had explained this deal to Saul, I think Saul knew exactly how David was going to kill Goliath. And it was with his sling. So you may want to ask me right away, was it really possible to do that kind of damage with a sling? And the answer is yes, absolutely. So this is not like a little slingshot rubber band, right, with the, you know, from the Little Rascals or something. This was the piece that tied around your arm, and you fitted the stone or other implement in a cup, and you were trained to release it at just the right moment. And slingers, awkward word to say, but slingers were used extensively in ancient armies. So what people did was what we're going to see David do. They would take stones from brooks, stones that had been in water that had been eroded down so they were smooth, or they made them out of clay. So you would take clay and you would make a sphere out of it, like a ball, you know, like old-fashioned round bullet, or sometimes almond-shaped, actually, they believe was aerodynamic. That's what they used. Later on, of course, they were made out of metal by the time you got down to the Romans and so forth. And those projectiles could injure and kill people, even through armor. There's a lot of research on this. In fact, if you want, you can go on to YouTube and you can see people really doing this when you go home. But we also have the historical accounts. We know that in the time of the Romans, a trained slinger, and you got to remember, if you're David and you're a shepherd out there, you got nothing to do all day except play your guitar and practice your marksmanship, right? Kids love to do that anyway, don't they, right? So a trained slinger in the days of the Roman Empire could hit an object the size of a person, you, at a distance of almost 400 feet. So this is no joke. And they've determined that the velocity in these things, believe it or not, there was actually an article about this in National Geographic last year. So they probably knew I was going to be teaching on this. And so, but the shot, they determined that the shot from a sling getting hit by this was just about the same impact as you getting hit by a round from a 44 Magnum. Because you're getting hit with a fired clay or a steel ball that is being slung at you at 100 miles an hour or more. I mean, think about it. A man can throw a baseball 100 miles an hour. If you have somebody that knows what they're doing, takes advantage of proper arm motion and has been doing it their entire life, that thing is probably coming at you, you know, 150 or 200 miles an hour. You don't want to get hit by that. And to make matters worse, the ancient armies, they would poke holes in them so that when it came, when the slingers slung their shot at you, it would make a whistling or screaming sound as it came through the air. So terrifying. You're out in the army. Here come the enemy. And all of a sudden, you hear this very terrifying whistling or screaming sound coming through the air. And then all of a sudden, everybody around you is falling over dead. So sometimes people have said, wow, it must have been David's confidence, something about his faith and his confidence made Saul feel comfortable sending him out there. And I believe that's true, because David was like the only guy there in the whole army that had any faith, apparently. But there was more to it than that. So not only did David have faith, he had some capabilities. But not only did he have a resume as a skilled shepherd, but he has faith. He says, Yahweh will deliver me. And he knows that God will be with him against Goliath. So Saul sends him out. And surprisingly to me, here's the first time that we see Saul, I think sincerely, since way back in the day, since he was a very young man himself, for the first time Saul actually even invokes God in a positive and sincere manner. So David has really made an impact on him. Now, remember the risk that Saul and everyone are taking here, because David has just been sent out as Israel's champion to meet the personal challenge of the Philistine champion. So theoretically, the fate of the entire nation may be resting on the back of a 16-year-old. So, all right, verse 38 says, so Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put a bronze helmet on his head. He also clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. And remember, Saul's a very big man. He was picked because he was the biggest guy in their army. David said to Saul, I can't walk with these, for I have not tested them. So David took them off. Here's your free sermon. Next time you get asked to preach and you're not expecting to get asked to preach, the world will always try to get you to conduct your life, your business, your ministry according to its methods, its ways, its time-tested techniques and ways of doing things as represented by the sword. You don't need them. They don't work for you. God can give you a different kind of armor, a different weapon, a different strategy, a different motivation. So, verse 40, then he took his staff in his hand and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, I like how it says he looked about. He was like, "What? Well, who are you? What? Really?" You know, he disdained him. That's ancient English for he said, "Give me a break." For he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. He was a pretty boy. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you're coming out to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." So again, Saul's armor is that ultimate symbol of professionalism, as opposed to David's total lack of formal military training and experience. What he did have was faith and anointing. Notice, what did David take out there in the field? A shepherd's staff. Who are we supposed to think about? Who is that supposed to remind us of? Moses, right? How did Moses deliver God's people? With the rod of a shepherd. And so it's very significant that the writer wants you to see that the giant is going to be brought down and Israel is going to be delivered again through a shepherd's staff. So common question, why did David take 5 stones? 5 is the number of grace. And so some people have suggested that this is a symbol of the power of God in the fivefold ministry, right? So that it's God's gifts and the power of Christ and his church being released against the enemy. On the other hand, on a more practical level, it's been pointed out by many people that Goliath did have 4 other giant relatives. Depending on how we read the text, it seems that he had 3 sons and a brother. So we don't know if David was aware of them or not. Maybe David was just, wouldn't surprise me from everything we've seen of him already. Maybe he was just a good boy scout. Maybe he was just being prepared for whatever happened, right? I love the faith of David. I love how it says, in contrast to everybody else was hiding and ran, it says about David, he drew near. Because at some point, that's what faith demands of us, right? You can have all the faith you want in your tent. But at some point, faith demands that you draw near to that giant and face the giant head on. So his faith was confident and active. His faith was not theoretical. And Goliath then is in disbelief. So verse 45 says, "And David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword, with a spear, with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air.'" So he's going to kill. He says, "I'm going to kill your whole army. "And the wild beasts of the earth, so that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And then all this assembly," in other words, everybody that's here today, "shall know that Yahweh does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." So it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran, love it, ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead. And all God's people said, "Ew." And he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of its sheath, and killed him, and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. I love how David speaks the word of God in faith. So here's Goliath cursing David by his gods. But David says he's coming in the name of Yahweh. That's his weapon, he says. And he'll not only kill Goliath, but all the Philistines. And this was David's real motivation. This is the motivation, really, for all of worship, which David knew quite well, so that all the world will know that there is a God in Israel. And did that not come to pass? Because, indeed, here we are still talking about it, something that happened like 3,050 years ago, give or take. So we're still talking about it. And everybody else in the world knows this story too, even if they're not a believer. I also find it interesting that David is not interested in accepting Goliath's terms of submission. Remember the little bargain, the typical bargain of single combat. David says, I'm not here to make any deals with you, devil. I'm not accepting your deal. I'm going to get rid of you, and I'm going to get rid of all y'all. So I make no bargains with you, devil. And I love that, because the devil will come and he'll want to make a bargain with you. Usually a bargain that says, you know, just lay off and I'll lay off you, which of course the devil would never honor that bargain anyway. And obviously the Philistines didn't intend to honor the bargain either, because they took off running. They had no intent. They didn't say, "Oh my goodness, the little shepherd boy defeated our scary Nephilim giant. Okay, we give up." No. They took off running also. So I love the very famous words, though. David said, "Everyone will know that the battle is the Lord's. God does not deliver with sword and spear. Praise God." And of course, Goliath got that haircut with his own sword as well. So verse 52 says, "Now the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted." Isn't it interesting? There was already starting to be this break there, by the way, between Israel and Judah. "The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shearim, even as far as Gath and Ekron. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine, brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, 'Abner, whose son is this youth?' And Abner said, 'As your soul lives, O king, I do not know.' So the king said, 'Inquire whose son this young man is.' Then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." So the Israelites finally find their courage and give chase, and they chase the Philistines all the way back to their major cities and take a great spoil. It may be disgusting to you and me, but David takes Goliath's head there, as you saw, as a trophy as well as his armor. Interesting, the reference to Jerusalem is outside of time here. It's an anachronism, okay, because the Israelites had not yet conquered Jerusalem, and they wouldn't do so until after David was king. So we have to assume that he took this grisly trophy there after he conquered Jerusalem. Very mysterious, very weird why Saul doesn't recognize David, and so he has to ask Abner. Remember, you may remember that Abner is actually Saul's cousin. You know, in those days, your general and people around you like that in the army, they had to be people that you trusted. Otherwise, you had to sleep with one eye open, if you know what I mean, right? So if you have a competent fighter who's your brother or your cousin, he should be your general in the ancient world so that you don't wake up dead some morning. But it's interesting. Why doesn't he know who David is? Maybe it's been a few months since he's seen David, and maybe David's grown up a lot. But maybe this is part of Saul's insanity creeping in, and he's in a state of shock, spiritually speaking. He's in a kind of a fog, because right before we meet David, you remember what happened? Saul had given him that prophecy and said, "The Lord is going to tear your kingdom away from you, and he's going to give it to your neighbor, someone, a man who is better than you." So now all of a sudden we have this the most amazing thing that has happened in Israel since the walls of Jericho fell down, right? So this is probably the biggest thing that has happened in the country in like 400 years. It's a big day. And David has already proven himself to be more devoted to God than Saul. He is more concerned for God's reputation than the king, right? He has more faith. And surprisingly, because he's only 16 years old, he has more physical courage than the biggest man in the kingdom, which is amazing. And he's also done something much more remarkable than Saul has ever done in his entire life. So much so that it's quite possible that this story here, this is the most famous story in all of ancient literature, with the possible exception of the story of Noah's Ark. So I think Saul is starting to see that his life, his career, his kingdom, it's all going sideways on him. And maybe he has this dawning perception of, uh-oh, who else but this kid could possibly rise up and take my throne? And so he's in a state of shock. That's my opinion. We're really not told, but so many stories of Saul's sayings and reactions to things, if you think back with me, many times Saul says things or does things and we're not sure why he's saying them, right? You remember some of this? That he's kind of like, we don't know why he's doing what he's doing. He's a little off. He's going to become quite insane the further he goes. So sum it all up, this is the beginning of David's public career. And obviously, David is entering the stage of national life with a big bang. But as I'm sure you know, it will not take very long at all. It won't be too deep into the very next chapter that Saul's jealousy begins to arise. He realizes that David is an amazing threat. Because this jealousy is going to be come to a quick flashpoint as the women come out with this famous song, this famous chant that Saul's going to hear in his ears at night, tormenting him. Saul has slain his thousands, and David has slain his tens of thousands. And that's going to stick in Saul's craw, and he's going to rise up with jealous murder against David. So that's what we have to share tonight. Very cool story. Questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah, Donna.
We have faith, but we have faith here too. We have faith on the
Question is, how does it happen that we come to a place of faith like that, like David, that he had such an assurance? I don't know. I think there's a few different dynamics at work there. It certainly could be a gift of faith operating in his life. So when you're dealing, when you're operating under a supernatural gift of faith, things look a little different, and you do kind of cross into this line, cross over this line where you really have that kind of assurance. I don't know if that's the case or not. We're not told. There are obviously some faith-filled events in Scripture which don't seem to be a person's normal faith, right? It does seem at times that some people did some tremendous exploits and God was giving them extra faith to go through that or to do what they did. It could have just been in David's training under God's hand, the next logical step, right? So God's up there planning David's career. It's like, you know, you're getting this down, angel. Okay, lion, age 10, check. Bear, age 12, check, you know, and so on. So that God builds these experiences into our life. So we learn how to trust him at level 5, level 6, level 7, level 8. So by the time you get to level 9 would crush your friends. But God already took you through level 5, level 6, level 7, level 8. You killed some lions and bears. You went through some things, some sickness, some heartache, some financial difficulties, whatever. And the things that would have crushed and destroyed you 10 years ago is now just my next step on the staircase. And God was clearly developing David for tremendous leadership. He was already like, you know, you read that early description of his little mission there from his dad. David was already like the best kid in the youth group. Just from how he responded to things and how, you know, right? Look at what his father gave him to do. And David's like, all right, I got this. Let me load up my cheese, you know, and so on. And he took care of it all, like extremely responsible. Whereas, you know, Saul was like, you know, a dodo, irresponsible, spiritually ignorant. Remember, Saul didn't even know who Samuel was and all these things. So that's all designed to show us that David was ready for leadership. And that Saul, by contrast, had not been ready and was never going to be ready. Leadership, and this happens to some people, right? Leadership would actually ruin Saul. It was going to destroy him being in that position.
I love the fact that David knew who he was, knew what his call was, and he knew what his call wasn't. So he said that when they tried to put the armor on him, he said, no, that's not me. It's not going to fit me. I need a spear or a little staff, right?
Yeah.
And Saul spent the rest of his life, not only did Saul not know who he was, but he didn't know who he wasn't. He chased David the rest of his life. He was distracted.
Right.
David's call the rest of his life. Instead of focusing on what God was doing in his life.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
He spent his whole life distracted. And we do that sometimes. Whereas the key to David, I think, was, like you said, he knew who he was. He let God take him through the paces, the training ground for him.
Yeah.
And then it was just a natural, it just came out of him, like when he saw the Philistine, it was just, that's just who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, you know, it's almost like, I'm not reading into it, but it didn't seem like it was premeditated. It was just who he was. That's
yeah.
Who God made.
Yeah. But it wasn't even about him, right? Yeah. It was like the same Yahweh that enabled me to do this, well, let me take care of this too.
But I just think, that's not, I don't want to say it's frustrating for God, but it is. Like, I've learned in my own life anyway. I mean, it's just like, we need to focus on what God's doing in our lives, not compare ourselves to somebody else.
Yeah.
We get so distracted.
Yeah.
And I just love how David was like, I can't pray that.
Yeah.
That's your one.
That's great. Yeah. You're teaching next week, so. but you nailed it, because the little one sentence obituary of David that you get in the book of Acts, it says, you know, David, he died, it says, after he served the purposes of God in his generation. So that enabled him to fulfill what God was giving him to do, whereas Saul never did. So that has to be our goal, right? That we would live in such a way that they could say about us, wow, he served the purposes of God in his generation. Because otherwise it becomes wood, hay, and stubble. But that's just a great point, brother. So, yeah, Michael.
Yeah, let's go back to the 40 days that Goliath taunts Israel with insults. If David did not come on the scene, I'm just wondering, if David did not come on the scene, would the Philistines and Israel have like an eventual cutoff where how long is this going to go on?
Yeah. Good question. Maybe not. Maybe there just would have been an attack. I don't know. But the 40 days of faith, who is it for? I think it was for the army of Israel. It was a trial of faith. Maybe God was waiting to see if anybody was going to respond to that trial of faith. Because it's quite possible that there could have been others who might have been able to, right? I mean, here's Jonathan. We saw a few chapters ago, Jonathan didn't even have a specific commission or a command from his father or from God. Jonathan just gets up and says, hey, let's go, and maybe God will help us. And God honored him and gave him a supernatural victory. Maybe God was waiting to see if that would happen again. So it wasn't a trial. The 40 days wasn't a trial of David, I think, as much as it was a trial for the nation. And then God said, okay, you flunked, but I had a guy, and here he is. So I'm going to introduce you to the guy now. So it's a great question. So, yeah.
Look at me. Mm-hmm. I'm really surprised there was cheese back then. I just want to know, this is the first time we hear mention of cheese in the Bible. I mean, they knew
it. That is a great question. Does anybody have like an app handy? I don't want to use mine because I got the recorder going, but you're going to be immortalized on the podcast forever for this. But it could be the first mention. I mean, cheese is real old, so. But I just always think that whoever experimented on these things first was real brave, right? Like, oh, I'm going across the desert with milk in my canteen, and I get to the other side of the desert. What's this? Oh, I think I'll eat it, you know? So, you know, how did they invent it? Who knows?
I mean, with Ezekiel bread and some tomatoes, they have pizza. I mean, it's true. Like, they have the ingredients before the Italians.
It's true. Well, actually, what you're saying is completely true, because the pizza was invented by the Roman soldiers in Israel. They took the pita bread and cheese and olives and olive oil, and that was pizza. They didn't have the tomatoes because the tomatoes were in the New World. Columbus brought back the Holy Trinity of food back to Europe there, because in Europe and Asia and the Middle East, they didn't have potatoes, tomatoes, or corn. Columbus brought all those back. So there was no... There was only white pizza back then, no tomatoes. So, but great question. Anybody find the first cheese in the Bible?
No, I just have a point, because remember Saul, he was hiding when it was about for him to do anything. They found him hiding.
Right.
And now this guy, David, he just like
great.
Runs forward.
Thank you, Marlene. Great contrast.
So many times, yeah.
That's great.
And,
another great contrast. Yeah, amen. I think Nina was...
Why did he question who David was later and not when he initially said, oh,
I don't know. It's weird, right? It's very mysterious, and I think he was just in a state of shock. We're not told, but it's just my opinion that he was kind of sensing his world was collapsing, because he could see that whoever this kid was, the trajectory of this kid was amazing. This kid was already, I mean, If you're not a believer, if you're not a Christian who knows the Bible or a Jewish person, does anybody even know who King Saul was? No, of course not. But everybody in the world knows who David is. And I think Saul was in such a state of shock, he was like, whoa. He was already getting into that mode of saying, you know, what can he have more now except the whole kingdom, you know, and so on. It's only going to take him a couple chapters to be literally throwing javelins at David. And so I think he was just like in such a state of shock that it just blew his mind. So, Lord.
I just wanted to piggyback. I just felt led. I read a book. I don't know the Bible as well. But David was a servant. And a leader, a good leader is a servant. Jesus was the best leader we ever had. He did for others.
Yeah.
And Saul wanted people to do for him, and David was always looking what he could do
right
for others and what we should be doing. I think sometimes we want to know why God isn't doing things, and we should be more servant like with our hearts.
Yeah.
And thinking what we can do for the kingdom and for mm-hmm. others to be, you know, not to look to be blessed, but that's how we should learn.
Right.
I don't know yeah. if I said that.
No, very good. You're exactly right, because a few chapters ago we saw Saul making a mess of things. And with David, right, David was concerned about the nation and he was concerned about God's honor. Saul made a mess of things because when they were fighting, he said, nobody is allowed to eat until I get vengeance on my enemies. So he twisted the whole thing around to make it personal about him, my enemies, my revenge. And David was not about that. Did you, sir?
Yeah, and then you mentioned the fact that in these times there was no tomatoes. For a long time, tomato was thought to be a nightshade and poisonous.
That's true.
And then somebody in Europe at one time said, oh, this is good. We're going to put it on the pizza to make it red. And that's how that happened. You know, but for a long time, the tomato was thought to be poisonous.
It's true. People didn't eat them because they thought they would keel over dead if they bit one. So. Okay, is this the first Bible cheese?
Well, we'll see. It says the earliest evidence of cheese making in the archaeological record dates back to 5500 BCE.
That's BC, yeah.
Okay, in what now Kujui, Poland, restrainers with milk fats molecules have been found. Earliest proposed dates for the origin of cheese making range around 8000 when sheep were first domesticated.
So it was Romano. Pecorino Romano. Jesse said, David, take this Pecorino Romano to your brothers. Shave it down real nice. So, but does anybody have the app out? The where's the first cheese in the Bible? Oh, okay.
According to Smith's Bible Dictionary.
Oh, perfect.
Mentioned only three times in the Bible, and on each occasion under a different name in the Hebrew. It's in the 1 Samuel 17, 2 Samuel 17, verse 29, and in Job 10, verse 10.
Huh. Job. So Job is... We think Job is the oldest book of the Bible, because Job lived just a little before Abraham. So cheese has been around for at least 4,000 years, according to the Bible, anyway. So,
wow.
So, and I guess that vacuuming is our cue to leave. So, thanks, everybody. Yeah.